tonight on Arena. Yeats versus Joyce, the heroic and the mock heroic, and a new 6-part documentary series on Ernest Hemingway. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In 1922 and 1923, Ireland reached two extraordinary peaks of literary achievement with the publication of Ulysses by James Joyce and the awarding of the Nobel Prize for Literature to William Butler Yeats. For many years, these two great artists have preoccupied the mind of my first guest this evening, Ambassador Daniel Mulhall, Ambassador of Ireland to the United States. And over a decades-long diplomatic career, Daniel has mined the work of these two writers as a connecting force in his various missions abroad. He's been tweeting poetry daily for the last 6 years and is honorary president of the Yeats Society. He recently gave a special online talk, in fact, still available to watch, connecting the work of Yeats and Joyce through the prism of heroism and their contrasting approaches to that theme. Yeats and Joyce, The Heroic Meets the Mock Hero is the title of that, and we'll tease a little bit of it out with Ambassador Daniel Mulhall. Now, thanks for being with us this evening, first of all, Ambassador.
You're very welcome. It's good to talk to you, and always good to talk about Yeats and Joyce. I've talked about them all over the world for the last 40 years, so good to talk to you this evening.
I just want, actually, before I get into the nuts and bolts of Yeats and Joyce themselves, have you ever been in a diplomatic quandary where either Yeats or Joyce was a great way of slipping out of it?
I don't believe so, but I've had many opportunities to use Yeats and Joyce to open doors for Ireland. I remember when I was in Germany during the economic crisis of 2009-10, I actually went on a tour of Germany with a little exhibition of the work and life of W.B. Yeats. And I went to about 13 universities, and I would always start my talk by saying, before I talk about Yeats, let me talk about the Irish economy. And I would give them my 1-minute pitch about the Irish economy and our prospects for recovery. And that's how I kind of managed to use Yeats to tell our national story to a German audience that obviously was interested in Yeats, but also might have seen some stuff in the papers about the Irish economy at that time, which mightn't have been very positive. So I tried to give a positive spin on the Irish economy while then moving on to talk about Yeats. So that's the kind of diplomatic use that I've tried to put Yeats to and Joyce to over the years.
Right. Well, I look forward to hearing the Minister for Finance using Yeats as a method of explaining the policies.
I mean,
over the next...
Biden uses Yeats all the time, so it shouldn't be that surprising that our minister would use...
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm sure our Minister for Finance is one person who certainly could quote Yeats and Joyce with great authority, I'm quite sure.
That's right. Forever the diplomat. Congratulations on that one. let us get on to Yeats. Really, I think, am I right in thinking, Daniel, that Yeats was the initial spark for you? Really, if I had to say, if you were allowed to take one book of poetry with you, would it be a big long novel by Joyce, or would it be a collection of Yeats's poetry?
Well, I think until recently it would have been Yeats's collected poems, because I bought that in 1976. With a book token given to me by my late parents. So I still have that book in my possession, and I consult it a lot. But I mean, yes, it would be Yeats, because, you know, when I started, before I started in foreign affairs, I studied history and literature at UCC. And at that time, I did my master's on Yeats and Irish history. So I was fascinated by the kind of overlap between the work of Yeats and the history of Ireland. And it's that, I suppose, I've carried Yeats around the world with me, and Joyce as well, kind of looking over my shoulder as I've kind of talked about Ireland and also thought about Irish history, because I always had this idea that there was something special about Ireland between, say, 1900 and 1920 or thereabouts, 1925, when you had all these great writers like Yeats and Joyce who were at their peak, but you also had, a political transformation taking place at the same time. And somehow I felt that the two things were connected, and that's why the work of Yeats in particular excited me. I moved on to Joyce more recently because I'm looking towards the centenary of the publication of Ulysses next year, and I've actually got a book coming out with New Island Books in January, in which I kind of try to unload a lifetime's experience of talking about Joyce around the world as well, and talking about Ulysses to audiences in different parts of the world. So yes, I started with Yeats, and now in more recent years I've kind of moved on to Joyce, but I'm still the honorary president of the Yeats Society, and I'm trying to support the society as they try to tie themselves over a very difficult time. They have a fundraising campaign at the moment because a lot of their revenue streams were kind of cut off when the pandemic struck last year. So I'm really hoping that we can try and save the Yeats Society, because it would be a tragedy if on the eve of the centenary of Yeats's Nobel Prize in 2023, if the Yeats Society were to go out of business. Mm. That would be, I think, a genuine travesty.
The actual, I suppose you've touched on it there, the period in which both of these writers were writing, it's such a vitally important period in terms of Irish history, political and social and cultural, in fact, as you touch on. But if you were to have the two men sitting in front of you, they'd have very different attitudes, particularly to the political aspect of what was happening in Ireland at that time.
And that's what I love about them, is that, you know, there's almost no overlap between them. I mean, Yeats, if you like, was the kind of purveyor of a sort of a spiritual notion of Ireland, romantic Ireland and, you know, the terrible beauty and so on. Whereas Joyce was more at the body of Ireland. He kind of probed and almost like did a kind of a post-mortem on early 20th century Ireland. And I think myself that you need both of those writers to understand the Ireland of that time and perhaps to understand today's Ireland. You know, the Yeats, who's kind of always writing about a vision of Ireland, that, you know, I mean, you know, he once wrote, Ireland is one of the seven great fountains in the garden of the world's imagination. I mean, fancy that. Joyce would never have written anything like that. But nonetheless, you need to have that, I think, inspirational side with Yeats and also the kind of more down-to-earth forensic dissection of Ireland, which Joyce went in for. And that's why I think the two writers are thoroughly compatible, because they almost, like, the two writers almost create a kind of a rounded, more three-dimensional version of Ireland, because they touch on such different aspects of Ireland. I mean, there's very little, you know, in Yeats about urban Ireland, whereas Joyce is entirely situated in urban Ireland. You know, the kind of people that were in Joyce's novels and short stories hardly ever appear in Yeats's work, except in some of those early 20th century poems where he dismissed the people fumbling in a greasy till. So I do think that the two writers are somehow, and it's remarkable that the two of them were around at the same time in Ireland, that you had such talent in the one place at the one time, and that they wrote about that country that, you know, we're now sort of beyond the century, beyond that time now.
You're touching in some ways on the yin and yang of the two writers in many ways.
That's why when I was asked to give this talk by the Yeats Society there a few weeks ago, I was asked to do something on Yeats and Joyce, and I was sat down to sort of think about what I would write, and I came up with this idea of the heroic versus the mock heroic, that, you know, in Yeats you have Cuchulainn, who's this great figure who fought the invulnerable tide and who governed the ungovernable sea, and when Cuchulainn is mentioned in Joyce, he's mentioned in the Cyclops chapter with this mocking litany of the great heroes and heroines of the Irish race. And of course, it includes Cuchulainn and Brian Boru and, you know, the Ordinary Maliki and all these, but it also includes Dante and, Muhammad and Buddha and all these people who clearly don't belong. So that tells you that this was not a serious list of ancient Irish heroes, but rather an attempt to lampoon the idea, this kind of, you know, the idea of a narrow-minded nationalism, which Joyce reacted against in the early 20th century before he left Ireland.
To what extent do you think that their attitudes, both men's attitudes, in fact, come from family situations in many ways? And if we think of Parnell and the attitudes of Yeats's father and Joyce's father to Parnell, very different attitudes and possibly passed on in many ways to the sons.
Yes, I mean, the difference was that for Joyce and his father in particular, and then Joyce inherited that from his father, you know, the death of Parnell, the fall of Parnell was the end of a great era when, you know, I think I wrote in that lecture that you know, had Parnell survived and delivered Home Rule for Ireland, you could have imagined John Joyce becoming a major figure in the Home Rule Ireland of, say, the early 20th century, and his son becoming a major figure as well. But actually, Joyce's father went downhill rapidly after the demise of Parnell. And to some extent, the demise of Parnell, you know, corresponded with the demise of the Joyce family. And therefore, Joyce is sort of, you know, turning his back on Ireland and going off and spending the rest of his life in continental Europe. Whereas for Yeats, when he looked back at that period in 1923, when he was giving his Nobel Prize speech, he talked about the fall of Parnell as bringing into being a new era in Ireland, which led to the Irish Revolution and ultimately to the creation of the Irish Free State. So for Joyce, the fall of Parnell was the end of promise and the end of an era. And for Jace, and for Yeats, it was the beginning of something which Yeats thought to be exciting, a turning away from parliamentary politics and a more heroic form of life coming into view.
What about the personal relationship between the two men, what we know of it? Certainly, Joyce was quite dismissive of Yeats, but as it turned out latterly, Yeats was very supportive in purely financial terms as much as anything else of Joyce.
I mean, I often say that Ulysses might never have been written had it not been for the various bits of sponsorship and patronage that Joyce received, both from people like Harriet Weaver and others. But also from Yeats, because when Joyce was really struggling during the First World War, when he took refuge in Zurich and had basically no income at all, Yeats actually managed to get him a pension, an annual stipend from the British government, which was a remarkable achievement, given that Joyce, them, they were preoccupied with the war and they were even wondering whether Joyce supported the war. Yeats responded that he didn't think Joyce had any views on anything like that at all, good, bad, or indifferent. But Yeats managed to get from the British government a subvention for Joyce, which kept Joyce going in those difficult years during the First World War when he was writing Ulysses but needed support, and Yeats was the one who conjured up the support for him. And Joyce was very grateful to Yeats. And I think after that, you see Joyce's attitude towards Yeats mellowing. I mean, he never becomes a kind of a
buddy,
a kind of an apologist for Yeats, or never becomes an enthusiast for his work. But certainly the kind of dismissiveness that he had about Yeats before that tended to sort of wane after Yeats came up with the goods for him in terms of this stipend from the British government. But of course, the other thing is that Yeats was given that Yeats, when Ulysses was published, was in his 50s and might have been expected to be a bit dubious about this new type of writing that Joyce was pioneering with Ulysses. But he was actually very supportive of Ulysses. I mean, when you consider the reaction of someone like Virginia Woolf, who was hostile and said it was the writings of an underbred person, an ill-educated working man. I mean, she must have had no idea what Joyce was really like. Whereas Yeats came to the rescue of Joyce and actually spoke positively about the book, and was one of the people who I think managed to establish the book's reputation, along with people like T.S. Eliot, who also recognized the value of Joyce's work. So I think over the stretch of their lives, Yeats in particular was very supportive of Joyce. Joyce wasn't the kind of person who tended to be supportive of other writers, good, bad, or indifferent. So I don't think that was the same. And anyway, Yeats didn't need the kind of support that Joyce needed from Yeats. Yes, Yeats was already a well-established figure by the time Joyce came on the scene.
I get the impression that the first cut is the deepest. The love of Yeats hasn't abated. Does that mean that I can take it that in most situations you're the heroic Daniel rather than the mock heroic?
No, I like to think that I'm a blend of the romantic and the pragmatic. I think that's the place to be. I like to think I have a pilgrim soul, as Yeats put it, always looking for for new horizons, always looking to find new things that I can integrate into my vision of Ireland, which I've been mulling over for the last 40 years, representing my country proudly and honoured to do so all over the world since the early 1980s.
And the tweeting will continue unabated then, the tweeting of the
tweeting will continue. It will indeed. I was about to stop it after 1 year when I was tweeting during the Yeats 150th anniversary year. I was about to stop. And a lot of people came to me, both personally and also on Twitter, and said, look, don't stop. We love it. And last year, during the pandemic, for about 3 months, I did readings from Irish literature, which I posted on Twitter and on Facebook. And I got extraordinarily warm responses. I mean, some of them were seen by more than 10,000 people, which for someone like me, who's not that well known, this was a kind of extraordinary.
What's the Twitter handle then, that I can give that out as well?
Is at Dan Mulhall.
Well, people can get a little bit of mindfulness there and a bit of pragmatism. Yeah. Pragmatism and romanticism. And thanks for sharing both of them with us this evening, Dan.
Yeah, you're very welcome, and thank you.
That's Ambassador Daniel Mulhall, Honorary President of the Yeats Sligo Society. The Yeats International Summer School is on every weekend through until the 6th of August, and Daniel Mulhall's talk on Yeats and Joyce is available online. The Yeats Society has recently launched a crowdfunding campaign to raise funds, as we, as the Ambassador told us, to help secure its future and to protect its the Ireland's poetic legacy for years to come. More information on the Summer School, Ambassador Mulhall's talk and the funding of the project, visit Yeats Society. And for a little bit of a poetry tweet, if you want it, go to @DanMulhall. Ernest Hemingway failed his medical with the US Army during World War I, so he became an ambulance driver instead for the American Red Cross. He was only 18 when injury at the Italian front forced him out of the war. It was the start of an action-packed life from 1899 through to 1961, a writer who'd win the Pulitzer and Nobel, who'd go to the Spanish Civil War, to World War II as a correspondent, and who would spend free time hunting game in Africa, fishing off the Florida Keys, drinking, fighting, marrying four wives, and watching a fair amount of bullfighting along the way as well, I would guess. Now he is the subject of a 6-part TV series simply called Hemingway. It comes from the documentary maker Ken Burns, and his regular collaborator Lynn Novich. Declan Hughes has looked at the first episode for us, and he joins me now. Ken Burns taking on Ernest Hemingway. Burns, American icons from basketball through to jazz and landmark events in US history, like the American Civil War and the Vietnam War, is the area that he's been in. Is he an obvious choice for Ernest Hemingway, do you think, Declan? And do we see hallmark Ken Burns in this series from what you've seen of it?
Well, I'm not sure obvious. I mean, it's a very quality production. I know people have had arguments with particularly the jazz series. And I think Ken Burns admits himself he would not make the Civil War series the same way as he did 20 years ago, 25 years ago now. But this seems to me a very quality production, very, very well made, and an alert to the arguments around Hemingway, because he's not an uncontroversial figure in literary history.
Yeah, that macho image, for one thing, which an image that he helped to create himself, it has to be said, and the lover of bullfighting, kind of fallen out of fashion in many ways. But it starts immediately in two ways. It struck me, it's not going to deny any of that, but it's also going to maybe open up sides of Hemingway that haven't been that much spoken about, to my mind at any rate.
Well, that's correct. I think Edna O'Brien is one of the stellar witnesses on the programme, sums up that side to Hemingway, saying he loved an audience, and in front of an audience, he lost the best part of himself by trying to impress the audience. And they sum up the Hemingway myth, the wounded veteran and battlefield correspondent, big game hunter and deep sea fisherman, bullfight aficionado, brawler and lover and man about town. And this idea of his performing masculinity. But what's interesting about that is when they look at his background.
Oh, yeah.
The depressive father, this quite controlling mother, and his twin sister, and the mother dressed the two as children identically, sometimes as boys, sometimes as girls, let Ernest's hair grow. And there was a strange, and what they're setting up here is a kind of gender fluidity, very much speaking to the present moment, which they're going to pursue later on. I think it comes to the fore in the work later, and also in the fourth marriage. So that's an interesting strand that's pretty much counter to anything that you would intuit about your received image of Hemingway.
Yeah, for sure. That early childhood, I mean, what a battleground that family must have been, because on the one hand, there was this encouragement. The mother was a musician, but she let the children know many times that she gave up her career as a musician to look after them. And the father had this great love of the outdoors and all of those aspects. So in many ways, it was the perfect mix if they hadn't had all the other baggage with them.
Well, yeah. And someone said that the mother was opinionated, controlling, judgmental and self-dramatizing, and Hemingway took after her.
You know? Yeah, where did he get it from?
Indeed.
The nature then, what also struck me about this is the words we hear from Hemingway himself. So let's take some of those. Here's one that particularly stood out for me. Hemingway himself just speaking about writing and what is good writing.
You see, I'm trying in all my stories to get the feeling of the actual life across. Not to just depict life or criticize it, but to actually make it alive. So that when you have read something by me, you actually experience the thing. You can't do this without putting in the bad and the ugly as well as what is beautiful. Because if it is all beautiful, you can't believe in it. Things aren't that way. It is only by showing both sides, three dimensions, and if possible, four, that you can write the way I want to.
And that's Jeff Daniels, the actor, voicing the words of Ernest Hemingway on the need for the good, the bad and the ugly in his writing. And that's from the Ken Burns documentary, Hemingway, that Declan Hughes is speaking to us about this evening. That's all very reasonable and all seems... Why have we got ourselves up at arms about Hemingway and his macho culture?
Well, you know, and at the time it was revolutionary. I mean, Tobias Wolff talks about him throwing out the furniture in the house to rebuild the house brick by brick with the value of the American declarative sentence. And what he did was he swept away all the fusty Edwardian, you know, the long Henry James sentences, and he brought in this clarity, this new... He was simultaneously a modernist, and we often recoil from that idea of him because we think modernism is Joyce and Virginia Woolf, and it's complex, and it's something we studied at university, and we don't want to read it again, you know? Whereas Hemingway was revolutionary in that clarity and simplicity and economy, anticipating... In some of his early stories, you know, looking forward to Beckett or to Pinter even, you know, and yet there's a wonderful moment where he's writing, he's a reporter for the Kansas City Star, and the style book for that newspaper, it says short sentences, short paragraphs, vigorous language, avoid adjectives, forward motion, and it could be Hemingway 101. You
I was going to say, well, it's a good style book for many things, broadcasting, article writing, book writing.
Absolutely, but not literature at that time. So what he did, and when he went to Paris, you know, with the introduction from Sherwood Anderson, and he was introduced to those great titans of modernism, you know, Sylvia Beach and Ezra Pound and Gertrude Stein, those influences are all present, but also that Kansas City Star demotic, that language of the syncopated city, of the speeded up, what modernism was dealing with, you know, the sudden explosion of modern life in the 1920s. And those two things oscillated, his style oscillated between those two. And that was so breathtakingly fresh, influential all around the world. Evelyn Waugh was knocked out by him, you know, and all the, he was the very much the epitome of the modern, the young, the new idea, you know, alongside Fitzgerald.
What a Paris he went to, though, and what a collection of artists and writers and thinkers that he met when he got there.
Yeah, the place where the 20th century was, Gertrude Stein said. I was working as a reporter for the Toronto Star, but of course he had married wisely. He liked later on to pretend that he was, you know, he was poor there. He was scrabbling, but he had married an heiress, Hadley Richardson, who said later, "We always had money. And we always had money for whiskey." So the Paris of the lost generation, and there's wonderful footage and photographs of him with Joyce, with Pound, and Pound was influential, as he was with so many of those writers. You know, he's working towards getting In Our Time, the first collection published. And it's been storied through legend, that period in Paris. It's still pretty thrilling, though. And it's very vividly evoked in this series.
The other thing is, you know, you told us there about the story. Oh, we were starving in Paris because, you know, we were well off and we could do whatever we wanted. Doesn't make for interesting reading, does it?
No.
But he seemed to start with that. What does it? There's somebody talks about that he told his stories, retelling and embellishing his war stories as he told them for a fee. It has to be said as well. This is when he came back from the war, and he had a terrible experience, was lucky to be alive. Many of those who were with him at the time of the particular explosion died.
He was the first American casualty ever, and he had 240 pieces of shrapnel that had to be removed. So he was a kind of a hero. And that sort of ignominious period where he is traipsing around, before he goes to Paris, he's kind of traipsing around, giving speeches and writing and not getting published and getting very frustrated. And the mother throws him out because he's a bad influence on the rest of the family and he's an ungrateful son. So he retreats and he moves off and then is taken up by Sherwood Anderson, who sends him to Paris with these value. And he was very charming, and he charmed Pound, and he charmed Sylvia Beach and Gertrude Stein, who's a considerable influence on his prose style. You can match and compare and contrast. That's all very well rendered.
Yeah, and the other aspect of that is, you know, that they said he didn't need to exaggerate what happened to him in the war. It was already horrendous. It was extraordinary that he survived. You know, he didn't need to add anything on to that. And if he'd stuck with that Chicago Star style book, which I'm sure somewhere along the way might have mentioned, if you're writing in a newspaper, only write something that actually happened as opposed to making it up. I presume that might have been mentioned somewhere along the way as well. What changed? Do we get to the point of that change, or is that going to come further into the series, do you think?
Yeah, no, we barely get to his first publication at the end of the first episode. I mean, I think what's interesting about Hemingway, that style, he became the epitome of, he was the great American novelist and the first modern great American novelist. And all of that stuff, all of that performative stuff, the man of action, was why his reputation was so extraordinary, because he was the writer who didn't just write, he acted out, he lived it. And I think that accounted for his huge success for so long, and then abruptly accounted for the reverse when that kind of stuff no longer flew with the rise of, you know, feminism and of a certain skepticism around that kind of the macho image of what that implied and what that encoded.
Yeah, and I mentioned that Jeff Daniels narrated one of the clips we heard. Peter Coyote narrates the entire series, as it were. Meryl Streep is in there as well, in later episodes. Let's hear him talking about bullfighting, because I just think you can't talk about Hemingway without mentioning bullfighting somewhere along the way.
I was trying to learn to write, commencing with the simplest things. And one of the simplest things of all, and the most fundamental, is violent death. So I went to Spain to see bullfights and to try to write about them for myself. I thought they would be simple and barbarous and cruel, and that I would not like them, but that I would see certain definite action which would give me the feeling of life and death that I was working for.
The voice of Jeff Daniels again there in the documentary series Hemingway. Declan Hughes, just before we finish up on it, Declan, do I get a sense, certainly in the early part of this series, we've only seen one episode, there are five more to come, is there a rehabilitation of Ernest Hemingway coming, or do you think he'll be set up on a big pedestal before they pull the rug from underneath him again?
I think they're following where you would want to go. I mean, I don't think they're going to let the arguments, from what I understand later on, they're going to let the arguments unfold. And, you know, the general consensus, which I tend to agree with, is that the first 49 stories and the first two novels are what you want to read. And then the work deteriorates and doesn't really pull back. And people do make cases for the qualities of the later work. I personally don't see it, but the extent of the quality of the first work is so amazing and stands, and I don't think has ever really been in question, even if it's gone out of fashion.
All right, and we can watch the next five episodes if we so wish to find out what way they're going to tell that story to us. Well, that's Declan Hughes speaking to us this evening. Thanks for being with us, Declan, speaking to us about Hemingway, which begins tomorrow evening, 9 p.m. You can see that first episode on BBC4. And so to the latest in our series of Book to Screen, Declan Burke looks at Elmore Leonard's Get Shorty, which finds the mobster money lender Chili Palmer infiltrating the ranks of Hollywood's producer class. It was adapted for film in 1995, starring John Travolta as Chili Palmer. Barry Sonnenfeld's film is one of the great movies about how Hollywood operates behind the scene, and Declan Burke is with me this evening. We are doing Book to Screen is what we're talking about here. So let's talk about Elmore Leonard. We've been talking about, in fact, I think Elmore Leonard contributes to that documentary that we were talking about at Hemingway. I think he's there in the first episode. So where does Elmore Leonard fit into American literature and culture? He's quite a pillar of that particular place.
He absolutely. I mean, while he was alive, he was considered, quote unquote, the greatest living crime writer, and that was American or otherwise. Had a huge influence on the way people wrote crime novels. He started out writing westerns, actually. People will be familiar with 310 to Yuma, which was adapted twice for film from one of his short stories. But in the late 60s, he was given a copy by his agent. He was given a copy of The Friends of Eddie Coyle by George V. Higgins. And it just bowled him over, not least because of the way that George V. Higgins, who was himself a practicing lawyer, the way he used dialogue, and particularly dialogue about the criminal classes. And he turned to writing crime fiction and just wrote a string of classics, particularly the middle part of his career. Some of them were adapted for film as well. Mr. Majestic, people will remember. Jackie Brown, which was originally published as Rum Punch, and Out of Sight. And we're talking about him as a crime writer, but even before he died, he died in 2013, unfortunately. By 2008, he had been awarded the F. Scott Fitzgerald Literary Award for outstanding achievement in American literature, and something that was fully deserved, yeah. I think.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the novel before we get into the film and John Travolta. The character of Chili Palmer and the plot that Leonard gives us in the novel Get Shorty.
Well, we could talk about either, because the two,
they're very close to each other.
Follows
yeah.
itself very, very closely. So it starts with Chili Palmer, as you say, New York born, but he's living in Florida. He's a Shylock, or a moneylender for the mob. One of his clients fakes his own death when a plane goes down and runs for Vegas and hence to Los Angeles. And Chili tracks him down, because that's what Chili Palmer does. But Chili's a big movie fan. Big movie fan, and he likes the idea of being in LA, and particularly Hollywood, and he starts to kind of feel and make himself comfortable. Bumps into a character called Harry Zim, who is a producer of schlock horror flicks, the real bottom of the barrel stuff, but Harry has plans to make a real quality pick, and he has stumbled across this screenplay that might make his reputation and could well be his legacy. And from there, Karen Flores, who is Harry Zim's ex, we have Ray Barboni, who's the mobster who wants the money back from Chili Palmer. There's Martin Weir, who's the egotistical Hollywood movie star, spirals out into a kind of comedy of manners about Hollywood itself.
How obvious a choice, how good a choice was John Travolta for the Chili Palmer character?
I wouldn't have thought he was obvious at the time of the casting, because in the year before, 1994, the film was made in 1995, was his big rejuvenation in the role in Pulp Fiction, which really reinvented him, you know, and made him this cool, slick kind of character, and was ideal cast then as such as Chili Palmer. 2 years previously, no one could have imagined John Travolta playing that kind of cool, hip, laid-back kind of character.
Yeah, well, maybe Sonnenfeld had got wind of what was happening on the Pulp Fiction set.
Very
and
likely.
Thought, well, you know, let's see if we can capitalise on that, because obviously he probably was shooting one as the other one was still in post-production.
Absolutely.
Let's have a listen to Travolta then. He's leaving a restaurant here, finds that his coat has been taken. Or borrowed, we might say, by Ray Bones Barboni. So he decides to go and retrieve it. Tommy Carlo, Chili's friend, Chili Palmer's friend, is played here by Martin Ferrero. He's in the clip as well.
Are you sure it was Ray Bones who took the coat?
That's what the man said.
Hey, tomorrow I see on the TV weather it's going to be nice and warm. You don't need the coat.
This is it.
Hey, Chili, get the coat. But just don't piss the guy off, okay? And we're going to have to call Momo and straighten the whole thing out. And Momo's going to be pissed off for wasting his time. We don't need that.
Don't worry about it. I'm not going to say any more than I have to, if that.
There we go. a clip from Get Shorty, the 1995 film starring John Travolta as Chili Palmer. In the midst of that clip, we also heard Martin Ferrero and Barboni wasn't in the midst of it.
He's the one you hear getting crunched there as well.
Get Shorty then, Declan, as a kind of a, if you like, a how-to manual for Hollywood screenwriters. Is this in terms of how it shows us how things happen in Hollywood, or in terms of the realisation of book to screen?
Well, in both. You know, it's set in Hollywood and it's about Hollywood, but it's also a novel about how a screenplay should be written, because Helmut Leonard had at this stage himself dabbled as a screenwriter in Hollywood. And it's also a delicious satire on how Hollywood operates. But what's very nice about it is that I've said Chili Palmer's a big movie fan, but he's very direct, he's very blunt in his approach, and he kind of inveigles way into Hollywood by peddling his own story, saying, what if I had a story about a Shylock who worked for the mob and he's chasing this guy and so forth. And that makes him seem like a bit of a maverick, because Hollywood, of course, is full of ear kissers and all the rest of it. And there's a lovely scene there's a character called Bo Catlett who was invested in Harry Zim's horror movies, and he has his own opinions of how screenplays should be written. And there's a lovely scene in which Chili Palmer and Bo Catlett sit down across the desk and have a little tete-a-tete.
But what do you think of the script?
Well, the first thing that's got to go is the title. I mean, this writer's name, Murray Saffron, would be better than Lovejoy.
Now, I'm with you on that one. You know what I'm thinking? Why don't you and I, we sit down, we write the script over where it needs it.
You could write one of these.
There's nothing to it. All you do, you get an idea, you set down what you want to say on paper. Then you hire somebody else to fill in the commas and shit where they belong, if you're not positive yourself. Maybe fix up the spelling where you have some tricky words. Although, I've seen some scripts, I know the words weren't spelled right. There was hardly any commas in it at all. So I don't think that's too important. All right, you get to the end. You write in, fade out. You're done.
That's it?
That's it.
That's all there is to it? Then what the fuck do I need you for?
Because I'm offering my services on this one, man.
Well, I'll tell you what. If I need a ride sometime, I'll let you know.
Oh, you got to be careful what you tell people. That's Chili Palmer played by John Travolta, Bo Catlett played by Delroy Lindo. In terms of hints, commas, that's all you need to be worrying about.
And the occasional misspelt word, apparently.
Yeah. All fine. So this is from the film Get Shorty, obviously, what we're hearing there. The screenwriter who adapted the book, the novel then, the Elmore Leonard novel for the screen, was Scott Frank. Did he follow much of his own advice?
Well, look, the easy thing to say, and as a fan of Elmore Leonard and a fan of the movie, you know, you'd imagine that Scott Frank was given one of the greatest gifts a screenwriter could be. You know, just take all the juiciest parts.
Yeah.
I'm sure it wasn't quite that simple. And if we look at Out of Sight, which came out in 1998, and Scott Frank also adapted that, again, very closely based on a novel. But Scott Frank does wonderful things with the way he mixes around the scenes and the way they appear in the novel and so forth. So I think it's an impeccable screenplay. Not quite as easy as I'd like to believe it was, but it's true. There are whole scenes and whole swathes of dialogue, that wonderful dialogue, that are just transported from the book straight onto the movie play
script.
Well,
we've just had a little lesson in screenwriting. Now, if you're in Hollywood, you've got the screenwriting side of things. Obviously, you've got the acting side of things and the actors. Do we get any advice or anything around, any ideas around how you might behave as an actor?
Well, you might get advice, but you might want to take it, because Martin Weir, who's the egotistical Hollywood star, is played by Danny DeVito in this and does a brilliant turn. So Martin Weir is, you know, he's been reading his own press and liking it a lot, and he believes he can play any kind of role. In fact, he has just had a smash with Napoleon, the biopic of Napoleon, as the film opens. So he believes he can also play the kind of mobster Shylock that Chili Palmer is, even though physically, obviously, there's quite a difference between the two men. But there's a lovely scene in which Karen Flores, who's Martin Weir's ex, she brings Chili to see Martin, and they sit down to talk about what Martin would do with the character.
Yeah, motivation is vitally important for any actor worth his or her salt.
I'm thinking about a movie.
One of mine?
No, one that we're producing.
With what? Wise guy money.
Maybe this wasn't such a good idea.
No, look, Martin, I'm not connected to that anymore. Not since I left that loan sharking operation in Miami.
What's the matter? The pressure got too much for you?
Pressure? I'm the one who applied the pressure.
Oh, yeah?
Now, Martin, Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You're an actor. Actors like to pretend, right?
We've been known to make believe.
Pretend this. You're a Shylock.
Mm-hmm.
A guy owes you 15 grand, and he skips town, he takes off. What do you do?
Oh, Martin, for Christ's sake.
I'm doing Shylock instead of a Shylock.
Right.
All right, what's my motivation? The acquisition of money to collect, to inflict pain if I have to. Guy splits with 15 large of my money, I go after him. What the hell you think I do?
Martin, look at me.
I am looking at you.
Now look at me the way I'm looking at you. Put it in your eyes. You're mine, asshole.
Danny DeVito, John Travolta, and Rene Russo in a scene there from Get Shorty. Declan Burke speaking to us about the screen adaptation, the journey from book to screen. What about the spin-offs from Get Shorty? Because there's been a fourth season of the television series.
That's
on the way,
right.
I think.
Done very well. And in fact, it was a direct sequel. Elmore Leonard had written a novel called Be Cool, in which Chili Palmer stays in LA and gets into the movie, or into the music business, excuse me, and stars John Travolta again. But they did not catch lightning in the bottle twice, I'm afraid. Not a marvellous film. 2017 was when the TV series started. Our own Chris O'Dowd stars as Miles Daly, who is, you know, like Chili, a mob enforcer looking to break into the movie business. I have done my best to stay away from it simply because I love the movie so much. But the word is very good, Sean. So maybe I should get over myself.
Maybe that's another item that's worth talking about. Season four. But we'll finish up with what I think is the standout performance for you, or performer for you, Gene Hackman.
Yeah, and because Gene Hackman has such a great reputation as a dramatic actor, you know, The Conversation, The French Connection, you know, it's a long, long list. In this, he does a brilliant comic turn, and there's a scene in which he tries to turn, he's heard Chili Palmer doing the look at me, and he thinks I can do this, and he tries to do it to Ray Barboni, who is the mobster hitman, who isn't going to sit there for it.
I don't think that's a good idea. Thanks for being with us this evening, Declan, and for sharing your thoughts on Get Shorty and the journey from Elmore Leonard's book to Barry Sonnenfeld's film. And we'll finish with Gene Hackman.
I'm talking about you, Ray Barboni, owning a piece of a major motion picture. How much of a piece is entirely up to you. What I'm saying is, you could invest part of the 300 grand that Palmer owes you, or all of it. It's entirely up to you.
Where's Chili Palmer? Where's Leo DeVoe? Where's my fucking money?
Ray, look at me.
What?
Look at me, Ray.
Did you just say look at you?
Look at me, Ray.
I tell you what, Harry. Why don't you take a fucking look at this? And have a peek at this. You know, Harry, this is the exact fucking thing I needed. A little fucking exercise after that long plane ride. You got a big problem, Harry. Harry? Well, come on, Harry. Don't pass out on me. Look at me, Harry. Where's my money?
There you go. Gene Hackman as Harry Zim. And Ray Bones, I should have reminded you there, warned you that there was going to be language from Dennis Farina playing that character. Pretty inevitable, wasn't it? And that was Get Shorty, book to film. Declan Burke speaking to us about that this evening. The Important Things is a new collection of poems from Irish poet Audrey Molloy, who's based in Sydney. Originally from Dublin, Audrey grew up in Blackwater in Wexford before moving to Australia. And from what we learned at Loretta to Lockdown Boogie, The Important Things explores the surreal, the dream world, and the everyday. I'm delighted to be joined from a very early morning in Sydney by Audrey Molloy. What time is it with you, Audrey?
It's coming up to 10 to 5 in the morning.
It's 10 to 5 tomorrow with you.
Yeah.
It's fairly early, so thanks for getting up to speak with us this evening and this morning for you. I suppose the thing about Sydney that is important in terms of your location is being by the sea. That's vital to you, I think, Audrey.
Oh, yes, it is. I've always lived near the sea. I grew up first of all in Dublin and then in coastal Wexford, within a stone's throw of the sea. And here I've always lived near the foreshore. So walking beside the sea is where most of these poems come to me. It's in my blood, I think, from when I was a little kid.
And was that always the case? Were you writing poems even as a child, or were they fermenting in your mind at that point, walking alongside the sea?
It's funny. I found a diary back in on a trip home to Ireland. I found a diary from 1981 with sort of childish entries for each day. And then in the middle of April, there's a line underneath it saying the end. And after that, there's a section called My Poems. And there's an index from A to Z of all these little childish poems. And I'd completely forgotten about it when I found it. But I didn't write Come to Poetry again until less than 10 years ago as an adult. And I guess during that time, they had been fermenting in there and they bubbled up to the surface.
Kieran Carson, I think, is certainly there in your thoughts when it came to your poem, The Irish for Yes. And I guess he's there because of the book, The Irish for No.
Yes, I love Kieran Carson's poetry, but my poem is on quite a different theme, and I explore a lot of themes of sexuality and I guess learning, yearning, and longing in my work, in part of it anyway. And so this poem, The Irish for Yes, talks to that a little bit about the body and consent and traditional roles, relationship roles.
Right. Will you read it for us then, The Irish for Yes?
I will. The Irish for Yes, after Kieran Carson. There is no Irish word for yes. On Inishere, upturned curraghs stud the sand like stranded humpback calves. Cumulus embellishes the sea. Egg white whipped to stiff meringue inside the sky's green bowl. Fishing flounder, easy if you're in the know. A foot of catgut tied below the weight. A hook to line the seabed where they hide. But I am not a tomboy anymore. Not game to handle ragworm bait. I ask the man in oilskins if he can do the dirty work. He says, I can. His Aran sweaters ribbed with blocks of honeycomb, I want a stroke. The sea turns navy blue. After, I'll send letters penned on onion skin. But if he writes to me, I will, I do. I'll never get the note. When my mother taught me how to knit, I practiced until I could turn out blackberry and trellis in my sleep. She also taught me how to debone lemon sole, split the flesh along the spine, lift the lattice bone. I asked the skipper if I might steal a kiss. He says, you may. His lips are salted as a pretzel, and when I open my eyes again, the sea is turquoise.
And that's Audrey Molloy reading us her poem, The Irish for Yes, and that is from her new collection, The Important Things. I wonder to what extent you trained initially, I think you studied, the sciences were very important. I think you qualified as an optometrist initially. Does that scientific side of things, do you think it feeds into the poetry in any way, Audrey?
I do. I mean, I think I've always been interested in science and nature since I was a little kid. And I sort of really struggled between the choice of the humanities and the sciences when I finished school. But I think particularly the life sciences and, you know, botanicals and all of that really is constantly in my work. I found, optometry to be probably not as creative a career as I needed, but I now find with my writing that I have a really good balance.
And I mentioned, obviously, that we're talking to you in Sydney, Australia this evening. What brought you there and what has kept you there?
Well, I came here as part of what was going to be kind of a gap year, like a one-year trip. I intended to stay here for, you know, maybe a few months, maybe longer. But I had in mind a different kind of Sydney. I had sort of pictured Australia, like what I'd read about in books as a kid, you know, in Neville Shute's book, A Town Like Alice, or Colleen McCulloch's The Thornbirds, sort of this arid, dry, hot place. And when I came to Sydney, I was just blown away by how beautiful it is and lush and green. And I just fell in love with the place. It's naturally just stunning.
And
I'm still here.
Why wouldn't you be? When you're there in Australia, are you considered an Irish poet? And when you're speaking to us at home, do we think, well, that's the Irish-Australian poet? Is there a touch of that goes on? Does that question come up much in terms of what you're doing?
It does. I didn't realize this was a thing. I was at an event in Sydney years ago, and a poet said to me, asked me, was I an Irish or an Australian poet? And I didn't really kind of get it. I didn't know what he meant. And I sort of thought, well, surely, you know, you can write a poem anywhere. But he said, no, a poet is connected to place. And it took me a long time for that to sink in. So I think it struck me only years later that I am an Irish poet, or an emigre poet, as you know, part of the traditional Irish diaspora. And that's very evident in my work, the themes that I write about. I think, you know, only a child can really know a tree and its various stages. And the trees that I know are Irish trees, and the landscape that I really understand is the Irish landscape. So in that way, I'm more definitely an Irish poet.
The second part of the collection deals with your mother. You might tell us the story that I don't know to what extent you're exploring it through these poems, or did it help you come to terms with certain aspects of her story, Audrey?
Yes. One of the most difficult things of living on the other side of the world is distance from family. And so when I was pregnant with my second child, my mother became ill with leukemia and subsequently died. And at the time that she died, I was about a week off full term with a breech baby, and I wasn't allowed to travel for obvious reasons to her funeral. And what I felt was my unique tragedy at the time is something that's actually happened to a lot of people in the last 18 months with the pandemic, not being able to go to funerals. So I think a lot of people related to the poems in this part of the book because of that. But I, you know, I try and explore some of my earlier memories of her and as a child, and then leading up to that tragedy at the end.
I don't know whether to ask you to read Charmed for me or The Space Between. Is one or other of those one that you would rather to read for me now?
I'd love to read Charmed, actually. I had planned to read this at my launch and I didn't get around to it. So it's one of my favourites from the book. So I'd love to read that one, if that's okay.
If you could, that would be great. Thanks, Audrey.
Charmed. On special nights in winter, my mother wears a tight-sleeved dress in emerald under fur. She lifts my fringe to kiss me and sings a tune her mother sang to her. Go to sleep, my baby, close your pretty eyes. But I don't close them. I want to lose my fingers in mink, inhale the Arctic scent of her perfume, and most of all, I want to listen to the tinkle of her charms. Sometimes she twists the bracelet in the nightlight's glow, shows me the golden scorpion, her honeymoon jersey cowl, the jet plane charm they gave to her the day she left Aer Lingus to have me. My favourites hide secrets, the tiny church that hinges open to reveal a bride and groom, a lion inside a wheeled cage, a disc of gold you flick with a fingernail to read happy birthday. This will be yours one day, she says, and tucks the candle wick to stop me falling out. And then she's gone. There's only Holly Hobby staring down from wallpaper at a child who doesn't understand that when the bracelet is hers, the charm will be broken.
What a beautiful, absolutely beautiful way of remembering your mother. And thanks for doing that for us, Audrey, in that poem, Charmed. Audrey Molloy from her collection, The Important Things. So what happens now, Audrey? Do you get on the phone and stay up for the rest of the day and talk to people in Ireland who want to tell you, I just heard you, or do you go back to bed?
I'm hoping to go back to bed. I might be able to snatch another hour or two before this kid's up looking for breakfast. So that's the plan.
Right. So family at home can hold off for an hour or two before they ring you.
Hope so. It's school holiday. So hopefully they'll want to have a lie in and stay right in bed.
OK, well, listen, lovely to have spoken with you this evening and this morning for you, Audrey. And thanks so much again for getting up in the wee small hours to speak with us. That's Audrey Molloy and her new collection, The Important Things Portrait Collection, is published by Gallery Press. And that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olam McGann. I'll be back with you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1, where we'll be speaking to Oscar-winning film director Thomas Vinterberg about the place of alcohol in Danish culture. Very interesting, given our own country and our relationship with that particular substance. But that's for tomorrow night.